Good evening, and welcome to another in our series, the Nussbaum Family Medical Ethics and Halacha Institute. Our topic for this evening is dealing with difficult patients. I want to thank, as always, the Bayit and Shari Shemayim for partnering with Beit Midrash Zichron Dov for this program, and the Nussbaum family for dedicating the medical ethics and halacha shiurim. I want to thank Dr. Pekas, who can't be here this evening, but who worked with the University of Toronto to enable credit for the session. A couple of other items before we get started. The next session, as of now, is supposed to be Monday, June 26th, Monday evening at 7 o'clock. The topic is compelling medical treatment. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to keep that date. As was mentioned right before the shiur began, God willing, I am moving to New York this summer. And the closing on the house there, as of now, is supposed to be June 26th. So that may make it difficult for me to give the shiur that evening, so I may need to give you a different date. We'll have to see. But to answer the question that goes along with that, God willing, the medical ethics shiurim will continue by Zoom next year via the Nussbaum Family Institute and Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, and with credit through University of Toronto and so on. More to be discussed, more to figure out, God willing, we will be set for next year. Okay. Other notes. There is an evaluation form, as always, for the session. It's very important for our accreditation that people fill it out. There is a link on the source sheet for it. Those who registered in advance should be getting an email any minute with it as well. It is important that you please fill out the evaluation. When it asks you for topic suggestions, you might want to take a look at the second link that's on the source sheet that gives you the list of past medical sessions, because it's always good to get ideas for new sessions as opposed to the ones that we've already done. Okay. Two last but not least. Number one, if you would like to get credit for participating, I need you to send a message in the chat. It could be a public message. It can be to me directly, either way. But it is required. The fact that you're in this and your name is on your screen is not sufficient in order to get credit. I don't record video, and I'm not going to sit here writing down the, you know, names that are on the screens. So please make sure to send me a message in the chat, and that way I will have you as signing in. If for some reason the chat is not accessible to you, you're on your phone, you have an iPad, and you can't see the Zoom chat, then send me an email during the session, please, and that will be sufficient. And then finally, please put your screens on so I can see you. We're only recording audio. We're not recording video. It's a lot easier to do this if I'm able to see people. If you're eating dinner, I don't mind. I ate dinner also. I know what it looked like. Don't be self-conscious. You're among, you know, friends. Okay. Thank you very much. So the agenda for our topic of dealing with difficult patients, the duty to heal in both secular ethics and Jewish ethics applies by default to caring for all patients. But what is a medical professional's duty to patients who think they know better than the professional or who simply reject medical advice? What is the duty to patients who do not respect boundaries? What is the duty to patients who fail to pay for services, whether because of means or for other reasons? So I thank all of you who sent me cases in preparing for the session. It definitely gave me direction. I put on the sheet links to some past sessions that we had. We had a two-parter about 5 or 6 years ago on practicing medicine in the Jewish community. And some of what we're going to talk about tonight actually began in discussions that we had then. We had a session a while back, about 8 or 9 years ago, on charging for health care. And that comes up in the discussion of patients who can't or won't pay. We had a session with the lawyers on legal ethics, vaccines, and your Jewish clients, which is going to come up when we talk about patients who refuse to have the MMR vaccine for their children. I will not be discussing the efficacy of vaccines and how we know they work and what the halachic standard is. That was fun, but not doing that again tonight. If you go to the vaccine share that I gave for the lawyers, I discussed it a little bit there. We also discussed it a lot in past sessions among ourselves. And then finally, the patient's duty to follow medical advice is a session that we had quite a long time ago that that is relevant as well. As I've said before, you know, with almost all of our sessions, I think, each case that we deal with is its own question. And for practical halakhic questions, please consult a competent rav. Okay. The session this evening is really not so much of a medical session as it is an overall ethical session. It's not so much about the practice of medicine, as it is, you know, dealing with people. I'm not sure of how much of what I have to say is going to be a novelty to anybody, but hopefully, you know, what we'll present within the context of Torah will be useful. So we begin with an introductory note. I'm going to put the link for the source sheet in the chat again. I see quite a few people have joined since the last time. An overall note, the obligation for a medical professional to heal patients operates on two levels. By the way, I should note, when you sign in the chat, if you're getting the emails already for these sessions, you just need to put in your name. If you're not already getting the emails for the sessions, that probably means I don't have your email address. And so please make sure that you send me that as well. You can do it as a private message if that's more comfortable. Okay. When it comes to healing, on the face of it, the obligation to heal others is what we call in Hebrew ben adam lachavero. It's a duty of one individual human being to another individual human being. And I gave you on the sheet in source number one just a few of the verses you could quote to support that. Lo samod al dam reyecha, do not stand by while another person's blood is shed. Vehavta l'reyecha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. Vahashevo solo, if someone loses property, you have a mitzvah of restoring the property to that person. It's bein adam lachavero. It's the way we deal with other people. You know that somebody is in need. You have the ability to help. Of course you help. And if you take a look at source number two from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, the Torah permitted a doctor to heal, and it is a mitzvah and part of saving lives. One who refrains is spilling blood. You have the ability to help and you don't help. That's a roteach. That's a murderer if you're talking about life and death. So on the face of it, if you ask me, what's the obligation to heal? The answer is a basic duty of one human being for another human being. But there's an odd passage in the Talmud which teaches us that there's another dimension to it. In a lot of you have been in sessions where we've discussed this, this other imperative as well. When the Torah presents laws of damages, where you have one person who assaults another person, the Torah says that the assailant has a responsibility to the victim and has to pay for a variety of damages, time lost from work, and depreciation, and among other things, ripui, medical bills. So since the Torah says that if you attack somebody else, you have to pay their medical bills, the Talmud says, I guess that means that Judaism recognizes medical bills. That means that Judaism recognizes the practice of medicine. And so if you take a look at source number three, they taught in Rabbi Yishmael's yeshiva, they said, I have the original Hebrew on the sheet for you, but I'm just going to read out my English translations for the sake of time. The Torah says, V'rapo yirapei, he shall heal the patient. From here we see that permission is given to doctors to heal. So says the Talmud based on a verse that appears in Shmos Chaf Aleph, Exodus chapter 21. And therefore we see source number four, in which one sage, Rav Acha, says that when a person goes in for bloodletting as medical treatment, and whether bloodletting is a good idea and when it is indicated is a great discussion for another time. Speak to your doctor before you do that, and your rabbi, why not? But if you take a look at source number four, Rav Acha said a person is going to go have his bloodlet should say the following, may it be your will, my God, that this activity should be a cure for me and heal me, for you are a faithful healer and your healing is true. It is not the way of humans to heal. It is simply what we do. Rav Acha says, you know, we mess around with healing, but God is the healer. The sage Abaye responds, not so fast. He says, one should not say this. For we have learned from the yeshiva of Rabbi Yishmael, the Torah says, and heal him, from which we learn that the doctor is given permission to heal. In other words, he says, once the Torah gives permission to heal, that means we understand that healing is a normal human activity, and being a healer is sanctioned and appropriate within the Torah. Okay, where am I going with this? Well, the question that you have to ask is, I don't understand. If we already saw in source number one and source number two that there is an obligation to heal, love your neighbor as yourself, don't stand by while someone's blood is shed, restore the person's property to him, failure to do so can be an act of shedding blood, then why do I need permission to heal at all? Why shouldn't there be permission to heal? Why does the Gemara need to tell me that there is permission to do something that I'm clearly required to do? So way, way back in August of 2009, one of the very first events that the Beit Midrash held was a program at the Bayit with a round robin of classes. I think some of you were there. And I spoke on the topic of the physician's obligation to heal and asked this question of, if we're obligated to heal, why do we need permission? And some of the answers that I gave at the time included the following. The Ri Meir Lion, who is one of the authors of the Tosfot, said that the permission to heal means you're allowed to charge for your services. That's one approach. Another approach that we brought at the time from Ramban, from Rav Kook, is that it's a good Samaritan law, so to speak. Lest the doctor say, I have no reason to intervene, I'm not 100% sure I'm going to be successful, and maybe it will cause harm if I intervene. So the Torah says, no, you have permission to do your best to try to heal. A third answer that we gave at the time is that it's actually addressing the patient. It's licensing the patient to take medication that might not work, and in fact might be harmful. Nonetheless, you have permission to engage in this medical activity. But the key for our discussion is that this permission to heal establishes the practice of medicine as partnership with God. And not only Bein Adam Lachavero, a human social enterprise, but it's that the medical professional is actually partnering with God. Which is why you have things like the source number five, which talks about a person who takes a vow. They're very angry at somebody, and they take a vow that they're not going to cause benefit to this other person. And then it turns out they're in a position to heal that person. So the rule is they are permitted to heal that person. They can't heal the person's property, but they are allowed to heal that person. Why? You said you weren't going to benefit them? That's true. However, this is your relationship with God, and your vow does not cancel out your obligation to God, and therefore, on that basis, you still would heal. So, why do I need a special statement to that effect? Why don't we recognize in any case that it's a relationship with God? All acts of helping people are also an act of fulfilling a divine command. Yes, but here, I might have assumed that medical care is actually philosophically inappropriate. Because if somebody is ill, the argument goes, maybe God was the one who made them ill. And by healing, by trying to heal, I am actually contravening the divine will. Maybe I'm going against what God wants. And classically, that was indeed a concern. And this text is telling me, no, you do not need to worry about that. So if you take a look at source number six on the sheet, Rashi says so explicitly, when the Talmud says permission is given to doctors to heal, Rashi says, and we don't say, God struck and he heals. Who gave you permission to go ahead and do that? Similarly, source number seven, Tosvos, writes that that I might have thought that you could heal an injury that one human being inflicted on another. But if somebody gets an illness that doesn't appear to have a human cause, maybe it will be inappropriate to heal. The Talmud is teaching me, no, it is still appropriate to heal. One last source on that, the Moshe of Zakenim, which is also from the authors of the Tosfos, says that I would have thought that if one doctor tried to heal and was unsuccessful, that would be a sign. God doesn't want this person healed, and you wouldn't be allowed to try to heal the patient, and it's teaching me that it's not so. So what we're getting here, and I'm rushing through this part a little bit because it's a little bit of philosophy as we begin, is just to say that healing is not only what we do socially, one person trying to save another person's life or improve the quality of another person's life. It is also one person trying to partner with God effectively. And it's about Adam Lamakom. It's about the relationship between the healer and God. Why does that matter so much? And why is this relevant for us? Because sometimes you have a patient who's uncooperative. Sometimes you have a patient who's antagonistic. Sometimes you have a patient who's making your life miserable, right? That's some of where we're going with the discussion. And perhaps one might say, well, if this is what Ben Adam LaChavero looks like, if this is what helping other people looks like, maybe I'll help other people, but not this person. This person has forfeited their right to my protection and my care. At a certain point, you just say enough is enough. There are enough people that I could heal who aren't making me miserable. But here we come in and say, yeah, but it's also Ben Adam Lamako. It's also your relationship with God. And even if the person doesn't deserve it, nonetheless, God still deserves it. Now, there are still leniencies when you're dealing with mitzvot that are between a person and God. There's a limit to the expectations that are placed on a person. There are situations where there's a cost involved in a mitzvah between us and God. And we say the cost is so high that no, you're not obligated to pay that price. It does, saying that it's between us and God, it does not mean that therefore it's an unlimited obligation. There are still limits on the obligation. But nonetheless, it teaches that the obligation to heal still applies even when the patient isn't cooperative. Clear? That's what I'm trying to get at. Questions and thoughts before I continue to the cases that we're going to deal with and the discussions that go with them. Wow, it was that simple, huh? Okay. Then let's go to the cases. And again, I thank you for all those who sent me their thoughts. The first case, going back to the first side. Susan, an experienced family physician, has a 45-year-old patient named Rachel. Rachel is dealing with multiple health issues, including obesity, hypertension, and an A1C of 6.5%. Originally, I had it at 6.1%. Barry said to me, nah, raise it, 6.5%. So now it's 6.5%. I think that takes her, by the Canadian standards, out of pre-diabetic and into diabetic. I think so. Okay. Her daily diet includes chocolate, soft drinks, and processed snack foods. For the past 5 years, Susan has strongly advised Rachel to modify her diet and to add exercise to her routine. But Rachel works full-time as a receptionist in an office and is a mother of 5 children, ages 8 to 20, and she says she has no time to exercise and no headspace to think about changing her diet. What can Susan do with Rachel? Thoughts? I see we have a Susan on the call, but I didn't have anybody in particular in mind. Probably have a Rachel here somewhere also. I can't see all the screens. No suggestions?
Put her on medication.
Ah, so let's try medication because the exercise isn't happening and the diet change isn't happening. So let's go to Ozempic or something. What can we do? I mean, the answer may well be that something more drastic is going to be needed. Yes.
At length. I mean, there are many things that we should all do to result in improved health, and much of the time we can't do them. We're not prepared to do them. We're not ready to do them. We're pre-contemplative. Whatever. There's many, many reasons why we don't do the things personally or our patients mm-hmm. do the things that we ask them to do that are obviously healthy for them. So it's a very complex kind of a situation with every patient.
Right. For sure.
She should get a different job, not a sitting job.
Okay. get a different job. We could help. We could try to advise that. Note in the chat from Andrea, keep trying to engage her, but you can't force her to follow recommendations. Find out what she can do. You try to work with her. Okay.
I think you listen to her. You seek to understand where she's coming from a stages of change point of view. You kind of poke at the places where she says she wants to change, but she can't, kind of like fine tuning it like someone else alluded to.
Mm-hmm. Good. All good. Esther.
I often tell people this very simple statement. I say people who don't make time for health will have to make time for illness. Mm-hmm. And I say it's kind of a shocking statement, but it's actually a very true statement. So I usually then try to negotiate what do they think they could do, just like the others were saying as well, because staying the way it is, we're almost guaranteeing that she's going to have to make time for illness. Mm-hmm. So I try to see if we can coax her in the direction that she likely wants to go but feels helpless and not being able to implement it.
Right, right. And I like the term coax as opposed to threaten. I think coaxing is good. Jeffrey has a note in the chat. Dietitian/nutrition assessment may well be part of the future for this patient. So first, just to say what I think all the doctors here are aware of, which is you can't drop the patient. That's number one. If you go back to the sheet at source number 10 from the CPSO, ending the physician-patient relationship. Physicians must respect patient autonomy with respect to lifestyle, healthcare goals, and treatment decisions, and not end the physician-patient relationship solely because the patient does not follow advice. For example, with respect to smoking cessation, drug or alcohol use, or the patient's decision to refrain from being vaccinated or vaccinating his/her children. So that's fairly clear. From a Torah perspective, of course, this is immensely frustrating. But no, you're not able to refuse the patient either. First of all, because we always say this, quoting a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, not everyone is healed by every doctor. And therefore, you might be the one who's actually able to help this patient. Further, we generally assume in Jewish law, and it's source number 11, but I'm not going to give the whole case there, that even in the most dramatic case where you have a patient who attempts to end their own life, you still have an obligation to save the life and heal the patient. So, you know, certainly in a case like this, there is an obligation to continue trying to take care of the patient. I suppose you could argue that here you're not actually treating the patient. Right? You could make the argument that in the case at hand, you're just giving advice that they're ignoring. But that brings it into an area of Jewish law that we are familiar with. There is a mitzvah of tochacha, right? Tochacha means instruction, right? It tends to get translated as rebuke, but it's fundamentally about educating and instructing others. And that remains as a duty even when people are not listening to you. And especially here, given the special relationship that you have with the patient, meaning they're coming to you as a doctor. They're coming to you as a nurse. They're coming to you as a medical professional. In truth, even though there is a mitzvah of educating others, of tochacha, the fact is that the Talmud depicts many cases in which people who are doing the right thing exist side by side, people who are not doing the right thing, and there isn't tochacha going on. We don't see any sign that the person who's doing the right thing is instructing the person who isn't doing the right thing. I gave you one example of it in source number 12. It's a very interesting case. They're talking about two siblings who are not observant of Jewish law in the same way. One of them is a chaver. This means somebody who has committed in front of a rabbinical court that he's going to faithfully tithe his produce and he's going to be concerned about preserving the laws of purity and impurity and all of that. The other one is an am ha'aretz. Am ha'aretz, not in the colloquial use of the term, somebody who's ignorant, but somebody who is not generally assumed to be careful about tithing and purity and impurity and so on. And they're brothers. In number 12, if a chaver and an am ha'aretz inherit from their father, and the father was an am ha'aretz as well, the father also wasn't careful about tithing. So the kid who's a chaver may say to his brother, you take the wheat in that part, I will take the wheat in this part, you take the wine in that part, I'll take the wine in this part. The idea being that he's able to exchange things, and it's not considered to be an inappropriate action in terms of exchanging untithed for tithed and the like. But my point in bringing this case is simply to say, nobody in the halachic discussion here says, hey, chaver, you're supposed to be rebuking your brother and telling him what he ought to do. There are lots of cases like this in the Talmud involving people who coexist with others who are doing things that are not right. And we don't say in every case, and you better make sure to tell them what to do, possibly because of source number 13, in which Rabbi Ilah quotes Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, who says, just as there is a mitzvah to say that which will be heard, so there is a mitzvah to avoid saying that which will not be heard. And Rabbi Abba says that's actually an obligation. He quotes you a verse from Mishlei, from Proverbs, do not rebuke a scorner lest he hate you. Rebuke a wise man and he will love you. So you would make the argument, maybe that means I don't have to keep on rebuking. But in the case at hand, that's not so, because they're coming to you still as a medical professional. And as long as they're coming to you as a medical professional, it becomes your duty to give them medical advice. And I brought you source number 14 from the Minchas Chinuch, who says that if somebody is not listening, but there's a possibility that you could find a way to get that person to accept what you're saying, that is indeed the obligation. So what can a medical professional do? So we've already heard some very good advice from the people here in the Zoom about what one can do in order to try to bring along this recalcitrant patient in terms of being patient, in terms of finding a way, in terms of giving them advice that's attuned to their situation. All of these are good. I just wanted to show you what I came across in source number 15. This was when I was preparing the lawyer session on vaccines. So it's an article from the McGill Journal of Law and Health called Physician Dismissal of Vaccine Refusers, a Legal and Ethical Analysis. And they offer what they call the 7 A's. And again, I don't think it says anything you don't know, but I like the organization of it. Number one, they say avoid confrontation, right? Strong messages tend to feel like an attack and they make people defensive. So avoid confrontation. Number two, accept, meaning recognize their autonomy, recognize their dignity, the fact that they have the right to their opinions and desires. Affirm, acknowledge their good intentions. Acknowledge the fact that they mean well with what they are doing. They're doing the best they can, or they think they're doing the best they can. Active listening. Hear what they're saying, because it will help you to strategize with them. Advise. Give them the information they need in order to make a decision. Advocate. Push on behalf of the vulnerable parties involved, right? In the case here, this woman has 5 children who need a healthy mother. So advocate on their behalf. Don't be afraid to make them feel guilty. And annotate. Document everything in the record in terms of the advice that's been given and the things that they've said, ideas that you have. Put everything in the chart. They also recommend trying to keep an open dialogue, making sure it's not, okay, we had this conversation and we're never coming back to it, but make sure that you keep an open dialogue. One last point, and then I'm going to open to questions and comments on this before you move on. There is another concern that the medical professional may have. You're taking time for this patient who is not listening to you, and you could have used that time for other patients who are going to benefit more from your advice. So that's something I'm going to come back to in the second case. It's definitely a concern, but it's one that we're going to come back to. Questions, comments, anything further on this one before we get to some of the harder cases? Like this one was a softball. Nope. Yes, Susan.
Would it be like? Could you just feel that you're not getting, or you and the patient? patient do not have the right rapport, could you refer the patient to somebody else that you feel might be more suited?
So there's certainly always a possibility of recommending to them that they, you know, take up a referral to a different practitioner, who either you don't like a lot and therefore you feel like they deserve this patient, or who you genuinely feel would be more effective than you. You can always make that suggestion. And in the event that you ever reach a case where you're dismissing a patient, you actually have an obligation to help them gain care elsewhere. But you can't force it just for the fact that they don't listen to you. That's really the key here. Okay, so I'm going to jump to the second case. The second case is one of concern for danger for other patients. Jonathan, age 7, is a patient in Susan's practice. His parents, who profess Orthodox Judaism, skip his MMR immunization due to their belief that the immunization is dangerous. Susan considers such patients a threat to other patients and wishes to find a way to remove Jonathan from her practice. What would Jewish law say? So here I just wanted to add for you, you probably saw this when it came out, flipping pages here, source number 16. This was a 2015 Facebook post by a physician in California, as I wrote there, during a measles outbreak. Message to his patients. How many of you saw this before? Anyone? No? Okay. In my practice, you will vaccinate and you will vaccinate on time. You will not get your own, quote, spaced out schedule that increases your child's risk of illness or adverse event. I will not have measles shedding children sitting in my waiting room. I will answer all your questions about vaccine and present you with facts, but if you will not vaccinate them, if you will not vaccinate, then you will leave my practice. I will file a Child Protective Services report, not that they will do anything, for medical neglect too. I have patients who are premature infants with weak lungs and hearts. I have kids with complex congenital heart disease. I have kids who are on chemotherapy for acute lymphoblastic leukemia who cannot get all their vaccines. In short, I have patients who have true special needs and true health issues who could suffer severe injury or death because of your magical belief that your kid is somehow more special than other children and that what's good for other children is not good for yours. This pediatrician is not putting up with it, never have, never will. A little strong. The clearly expressing a lot of frustration there and getting it out on Facebook, I'm sure, is always a good idea. What's social media made for, if not a rant that could get you in trouble? So this is one physician's way to express frustration about the situation. The doctor believes that a patient is endangering other patients medically. So clearly, by law, the rule is still that you're not allowed to dismiss. This is still not grounds for dismissing a patient. However, what about within halacha? I mean, in other words, there's an explicitly stated concern that this patient is going to be a threat to other patients in the waiting room, aside from people in general society. What do you think? Is that grounds within halacha to turn away a patient? You're going to guess no. Okay. Guessing is always fun. There's a note in the chat. These might be appropriate terms and conditions when a patient is signing up for your care. That's interesting. Any of the doctors want to weigh in on that? Can you set this up as a requirement for when patients enter your practice that you can only join my practice if you're going to vaccinate? Is that a thing?
You can set it up, but you can't enforce it.
Got it. Unenforceable terms. Those are always fun. Okay. Yes, Dr. Libman. The other Dr. Libman this time. Yeah. I can't hear you. You're not muted, but I still can't hear you. Out of luck. Sorry. If you want to write it in the chat, though. Anyone else? Yes, Zev.
We've talked before about halacha requiring what is the likelihood odds of something happening in a certain circumstance.
Right.
You can say
But you're still stuck in the situation where they have a stage of illness where you believe they're infectious to others, but they need your care.
Not in the office.
Not in the office. Then you say, sorry, it's telemedicine for you.
Could be. You might even make your own visit on your own because of an adult or the physician is likely to be immune. It's not a risk. But you can't expose an office full of people.
Mm-hmm. I hear that. So that may be your obligation, is just do what you can to take care of them while protecting the other patients. Okay.
Question though.
Yeah.
So you're telling them don't come in the office because you're not vaccinated. What if they walk into the office? Can you throw them out?
Well, that would definitely be part of this problem. And that's where Dr. Kirshen says you can make it, but you can't enforce it.
Actually, that specific statement is called trespass.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, in the secular world, a legal option. Whether you would do it is a different story.
Yeah. Now, that's where I was stuck. Yeah. Dr. E. Libman.
Okay. I find that this is a very tricky situation. These people are often intelligent. They seem to fall for conspiracy theories. I actually feel rather badly for them. I feel worse for their children. I do try to tell them, what that pediatrician wrote, that's every doctor's envy, that he would love to write that. I don't have the guts to write that. But I do bring them in at the end of the day, or I'll whisk them into a room all by themselves. And when I get there, I'll get there, and I explain to them that I have to finish everyone first before I get there. So that there's probably a little bit of a punishment, I suppose. Because you don't want to infect other kids, and you want to make some kind of concession of being compassionate for people who hold conspiracy views.
Mm-hmm.
I feel badly for them, but I certainly don't want to have any patients that pediatrician wouldn't see. I don't want them to come to my office either. Well, okay, I'm not a pediatrician, but I see enough of kids. So I don't want them either. I don't want to have to concentrate on other people's rejects. I think everyone who gets their anti-vaxxers should keep them, be compassionate, and try to persuade them. I did persuade one anti-vaxxer, and I said that my patients with leukemia hate your guts. I just want you to know. And I think that you may not feel how hateable you deserve, but it's unbelievable. They look at you and your kids as a major threat.
Mm-hmm.
And so she did allow me to then inject her kids with the vaccination because I said that your kids could kill other children.
Wow.
And so that's, it was a bit dramatic, but I just wanted to put it right out there.
Right.
That this is not a casual decision that she's making.
Right.
It really has the potential to kill other people.
Right.
So that did work. But I do try to be compassionate. I said, look, I feel your pain. I feel it. On the other hand, I don't want your kid to kill that kid.
Right.
That's a big problem for me. And I try to get her to resolve it.
Right. Okay, so. Thank you. Michael, and then we're going to go a little further because I have a halachic model that I think works for this.
One of the things that occurs to me is that we feel punitive in a way to people who brought things on themselves. But the fact is that most things that people come to are things that, in fact, they've contributed many things. They've exposed themselves to various things. They smoke, they don't breathe, they don't exercise, they don't do all sorts of things. And so to sort of single out a group that we want to punish especially, and it could be the fact is that the MMR is not 100% effective. They could have had the shot and still got the illness.
Right.
And so, again, we it sounds like we're struggling around our psychological need to punish people who don't agree with us, and that's it's troubling.
Well, the same thing is true in the first case that we looked at, right? The the woman who has all of these signs of serious health problems that require change of lifestyle and just isn't doing it. There's a sense of, well, she did this to herself, which isn't necessarily fair. So definitely true. It's definitely in there. So I think within halacha, we actually have a model for this concern about the patient who's going to harm others. It's a field of education. It's called Talmid She'eno Hagun, a student whose behavior is inappropriate. It betrays bad character. Now, there's an awful lot to be said about segregating students. That's not our discussion in this session. But I have to show you source number 17. Hebrews at the bottom of one side, English is at the top of the next side. Rabbi Yehuda said, quoting Rav, "One who teaches a student who is not hagun," and again, I'm taking not hagun to mean of bad character, "will fall into Gehenna," and they quote a verse to support that. Rabbi Zera said, quoting Rav, "One who teaches a student who is not hagun is like one who hurls a stone to Marcolis. It's a particular type of idolatry which was worshipped by throwing stones at it. And a person might throw a stone at this idol thinking, I'm doing something against the idolatry, but you're actually serving it. So too here, you think you're doing something good by teaching this person Torah, but what you're doing is actually bad." Now, what's wrong with teaching Torah to a student of bad character? So some make the argument that the concern is that this student is going to take whatever you teach him and use it in bad ways, in harmful ways. But Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid voiced a different consideration. It's about the other patients, so to speak. If you take a look at source number 18, and he says it in a few different places, writing in 12th century Germany, he said, "If a sage has students, and one of them tries to fight with the Rav and with the other students, it would be better to expel the one to benefit the others who are good. Get rid of this student who is a bad influence, who is disruptive, in order to be able to teach the other, the remaining students." And halachic authorities bring this idea about excluding somebody who is a threat to others. The Divrei Yatziv, the Kloisenberger Rebbe, talked about this, where there are students who could be harmed. Rav Moshe Feinstein dealt with this as well and recommended that. No less a tolerant figure than Rabbi Avram Yitzchak Cook talked about this and about the need to sometimes exclude. In source number 19, he distinguished between three categories of dangerous person. There's the Adam Ra, there's the Chaver Ra, and then there's the Shachein Ra. In source number 19, the Adam Ra, the bad person, is somebody whose brazenness goes stronger because of something in his character, in his spirit. And then he says there are those whose nature is not inclined to brazenness, but because he's with us and because of the conflicting traits and character, that causes him to be brazen. That's the Chaver Ra. There's just something bad in the social dynamic that's leading to bad behavior. And then he says there are those who are not awakened to this ugly trait of brazenness due to community either, but when there are conflicting activities, these activities awaken opposition and jealousy. They're not on board with the program. And trying to be in the program is what's causing them to act out, and that's a shachin ra. And he says they're harming others, and there may indeed be a need to separate and exclude. So, taking that from the educational side of things and applying it to the medical side of things, does that lead to the possibility that we would in fact say that the patient who's endangering others should be excluded? So I think the answer would probably be along the lines of what some of you recommended, which is the mitigation tactic. You keep them, but you try to mitigate the harm. If you take a look at source number 20, this is the advice of the Rambam, of Maimonides, regarding this student. "One may only teach Torah to a student who is hagun, pleasant in his deeds, or a tam, an innocent, simple student. He's not great, but on the other end, he's not destructive either. But if he travels a path which is not good, we bring him back to good and guide him in a straight path and examine him, and then we bring him into the Beit Midrash and teach him." So the answer to this, the case in which you have a student who is disruptive is not kick him out. The answer is find a way to teach him in a different setting and get to a point where he's not a threat, and then mainstream him. Bring him back into the community. Not unlike what I heard from you about treating the patient in a room of their own at the end of the day, or seeing them with a visit, and the like, in order to find ways to help them until they can be brought back. Clear? Okay. So that brings us to case number three. And case number three was easily the one that I heard versions of most from you. I thank the doctors who sent different versions of this to me. Rivka, age 65, is a patient in Susan's practice, as well as a congregant in the same synagogue. She requests Susan's assistance in bypassing the hospital wait to facilitate a laminectomy for debilitating back pain. Susan investigates and determines that Rivka does not qualify for the highest need category. Rivka does not respond well to this news and insists that Susan find some way to help her. While in synagogue that Shabbos, Susan is informed by a colleague that Rivka has been bad-mouthing her for being, quote, unresponsive and irresponsible. What advice could Judaism give to Susan, who's being bad-mouthed by the unhappy patient? I'm not going to ask people to raise their hand if this sounds familiar, because I don't want, you know, to ask physicians to incriminate either themselves or their patients. But like I said, this, I heard versions of this from quite a few different doctors. One note in the chat recommending MAID. Ouch. That tells me how you feel, Sheldon. Refer them to the doctor in California that we mentioned before. What advice can you give a doctor who is now being bad-mouthed in shul? Go to a different shul? Go out to the Kiddush Club? I mean, what advice are we giving to the doctor?
Talk to Rav about a session on Lashon Hara and Hefilut.
Oh, thank you. As a rabbi, I appreciate that. Talk to the rabbi about a session on Lashon Hara. You know, a rabbi said to me recently that he was talking about holding a session in his community on kashrus. He says, the people who are going to come to the session on kashrus aren't really the ones that I'm concerned about. I think that may be true for the session about Lashon Hara as well. So here's what I see. I see two basic approaches. Approach number one is help the patient get the laminectomy. They don't qualify, but it's self-preservation. Now, the problem with doing this is that it harms other people who are waiting for treatment, right? I'm not allowed to protect myself from Lashon Hara by harming other people. This is a principle in the Gemara. It's in source number 21, the Gemara in Bava Kamma. A man loaded a donkey on a boat before people entered the boat. The boat was going to sink. So he loaded the donkey on the boat. Everybody else gets on the boat. The boat is going to sink from the donkey. So one man pushed the donkey into the water and it sank. The donkey owner came to Rava, who exempted the man from liability. He said, you're not liable for what you did to this man's donkey. Abaye challenged, what do you mean? He saved himself with another person's property. You're not licensed to do that. So Rava acknowledges that. That's true. But this was a different story because the person who put the donkey on the boat was actively endangering other people. But in a case where they're not actively endangering other people, this person with the laminectomy or the desire for a laminectomy is not necessarily viewed as directly harming other people. So you're not allowed to save yourself by putting this person ahead of other people who really need the treatment, especially when you consider, and we talked about this when we had the session on practicing medicine in the Jewish community, the rule is that people who are waiting in a queue actually have certain rights for a variety of reasons, which I brought on the sheet, but I'm just going to summarize. Number one, in source number 22, we are taught that that if two boats are passing in a river and they encounter each other and both pass each other, they try to go at the same time, then both of them is going to sink, but they could go in sequence. The rule is that the one that was there first has the right to go first, as opposed to if they arrive at the same time when you have to figure it out. But the one who arrives first has precedent. That's number one. Number two, as Rabbi Waldenberg notes in source number 23, by social order and social convention, we honor lines. It's just what everybody agrees to. And in source number 24, the Chazon Ish actually is quoted as saying explicitly that moving ahead of another person in line violates the Torah's rule of Hasagas Gevul, trespassing a boundary. You entered into their space by cutting the line. So the people who are supposed to be first and who have been waiting have certain rights, and to violate those rights in order to save yourself from Lashon Hara would seem to be problematic. So that leads to approach number two. Approach number two is fight the gossip by telling people the truth. When you hear in shul that this person is saying this about you, so just tell them, no, they don't qualify. Well, from a secular perspective, I'm not so sure that you're able to do that. The Law Society, interestingly, in their Rules of Professional Conduct, does envision permission for a lawyer to disclose information in self-defense. In medicine, I have yet to find anything that would justify being able to disclose that. I see all the head shakes. No. See, this is why it's valuable to have people's screens on. If your screen is off and you're shaking your head, no, I'll never be aware of it.
You can breach confidentiality is if there's a potentially imminent danger to somebody else.
Right. And we've talked about that. We've had sessions on danger to somebody else. I find it hard to believe that you would be able to do this, from a secular perspective. In halacha, the argument can be made that Lashon Hara in self-defense could be permitted, but it's a pretty high bar to get there. It's not simple and straightforward. The only thing that I really can say for somebody who is a medical professional who's in this position, is that you have a lot of predecessors in Tanakh. You have a lot of great figures in Tanakh who sat in the seat where you now sit. If you think of Moshe with Dasan and Aviram, right? If you think of David with Avner and Doeg, who keep telling Shaul that David is trying to hurt him, if you can think of any number of Nevi'im, of prophets who had this sort of situation in which people didn't like what they had to say and they gave them a hard time. There's a history of this, because there is an understanding that when you are doing what you're supposed to do, there will be people who are going to be unhappy about it. I see the note in the chat. We haven't raised the possibility of approaching the patient who is spreading the rumors. That's true, and I wish you luck. You certainly can. Like, why not? But I didn't have the sense from the doctors who submitted these cases that they thought that was effective. Go for it. Absolutely go for it. But if it works, that's wonderful. My understanding is that generally speaking, people who feel self-righteous and wounded, tend to go on feeling self-righteous and wounded. That's my sense of it. Other questions or comments on this vignette? Yes, Dr. Libman E.
With the idea of sending her out of my practice, because I know how hard I work and how I feel quite devoted, and I would feel extremely uncomfortable putting somebody who really didn't merit ahead of other people, which means you really do harm other people on the wait list. And I think I would explain that I just don't think I can provide the kind of care she wants, and I'm uncomfortable continuing the relationship.
Right. So I'm hearing two different things, actually, in what you just said. Number one, and really I guess I should have said this in the beginning of the case because it's really important, is a lot probably depends on how you explain things to the patient. There's a difference between saying, sorry, you don't qualify, and going into a lot of depth, taking the time to really explain what the issues are and why having this patient go ahead would be a problem, to the point where they'll be sympathetic and they'll recognize that what they're requesting really isn't fair. So that's one piece that I heard within what you were saying, and I think that I probably should have put that first in the conversation. Number two goes with what Andrea wrote in the chat. Depending on what is being said, it might be seen as a breakdown in doctor-patient relationship. Right. That's an issue in its own right, which is found, interestingly, in law as well. When they talk about dropping a client and the potential that there's a lack of confidence in that relationship, if it's really gotten that far, it may be time to suggest referring, you know, and to, you know, that won't end the Lashon Hara, mind you. This will not actually end the Lashon Hara. However, it may at least make them someone else's problem. Dr. Saffer.
Yeah, I like questions. I would ask the question of the person who's coming to me and say, do you know what the real story is?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you getting your information from? Is the information reliable?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the real facts of the case? And maybe you could go back to the person has told you this and ask them those questions.
Oh, so you're not talking about asking the patient questions as part of helping them to understand. You're talking about asking the people who are reporting to you.
Both.
Mm-hmm. You'd have to be very, very careful with how you ask questions to make sure you're not considered to be divulging information.
Absolutely. No, you say, I'm not divulging any information, but do you know the real facts of the case?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Hi, it's Pearl. I wanted to say something.
Yeah, please.
First of all, this is a question that definitely represents Canada, you know? I'm saying in terms of waitlisting and the whole...
Yeah.
The whole big, you know, because in New York, you know, you would just go somewhere else to another facility and you'd get your surgery. But I was going to say that I think that part of our role, we get that, you know, patients who don't want to follow instructions, patients who aren't full diabetics and have no idea, listen... So do we let them leave our practice? Do we keep them in our practice? Like, my point is I think we keep them in our practice because, you know, no one else is going to deal with it any better than I'm going to deal with it. I think you're right. I think we have to keep educating the patient about, you know, the whole story and, you know, and the ultimate goal for me in terms of my practice is not going to be, you know, if someone's saying Lashon Hara about me, but whether I'm doing the best for my patient.
Right. You and Moshe and David and all the Nevi'im. Okay. Should we go on to case number four? All right. So case number four, going back again to the first side, was the patient who isn't paying. David, a licensed psychotherapist, sees patients who pay with private insurance or out of pocket. Reuven, age 35, has been seeing David for moderate to severe depression for 6 months. But has not paid for the last 3 appointments. Would Jewish law allow David to dismiss Reuven from his practice? For not paying for 3 months? Moderate to severe depression. So, CPSO policy is in source number 25. In circumstances where a patient has refused to pay an outstanding fee or has accumulated a number of unpaid fees and provided no reasonable justification for non-payment, such as evidence of financial hardship, physicians must A, consider the financial burden that paying the fee will place on the patient, B, if appropriate, consider waiving or allowing for flexibility with respect to fees based on compassionate grounds, and C, undertake discontinuation in accordance with the general expectations of this policy, including that reasonable efforts be undertaken to resolve the situation in the best interest of the patient, right? The steps for dismissing a patient include, as we said before, referring them to somebody else to make sure that there is a continuity of care on their behalf. But clearly, CPSO wants you to do everything possible to avoid discontinuation, take into consideration their situation, see if there can be something done for, you know, compassion for the patient. In Jewish law, we've already said, there is an obligation to treat, right? Ben adam lamakom, ben adam lachavero, whether in terms of my duty to others or whether in terms of my duty to God. There's a classic passage at the end of Kiddushin in which we are told, Tov sheberofim legehinom, the best of doctors is destined for Gehenim. What does that mean? So there are a lot of explanations for what that means. I think I've discussed it in sessions before. But Rashi, in source number 26, says, this is talking about somebody who is arrogant. Eino mishaber libo lamakom. He does not subdue his heart before God. Sometimes he actually kills because he's not careful. And the part that's relevant for us, he is able to heal the poor, but he does not heal somebody who says, I'm not going to treat because they can't afford to pay me. As a matter of fact, in Jewish law, it is possible for a rabbinical court to coerce somebody who is a medical professional to practice. If you take a look at source number 27, Rabbi Waldenberg is discussing in context a law that's found in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, saying that a rabbinical court is able to compel a moel. I see a moel on this screen. The rabbinical court is able to compel a moel to do a bris, even if the family is not able to pay. So Rabbi Waldenberg comments on that and says, the reasoning of Rabbi Isserles about compelling a moel is not relevant here in a case of compelling a doctor, unless we would say that when a patient lacks the ability to heal himself, the court, as the hand of the needy, is obligated to heal this needy person. I should say this a little bit more explanation. The rationale for the court being able to coerce a moel is because the rule is that where the parents are not taking care of a bris, the rabbinical court is obligated to take care of the bris. So since they are obligated, therefore they are able to coerce the moel. So he says, along the same lines, the court is supposed to stand up for indigent people, so maybe it's also their duty to heal this indigent person, and therefore they could compel a doctor. This would be a function of the Torah's obligation of, you shall restore it to him, restoring a person's property to him, which includes loss of his body. Since this obligation rests upon the court, they can compel the doctor with the court's powers to heal for free, like in the case of circumcision. So there is precedent in Judaism for saying you're going to have to treat even if you're not going to get paid. There is precedent. However, there are two considerations here. Number one, what about the argument that there are other doctors and so I am not robbing him of healthcare? He can go to somebody else. So we did say before that there's a concern that not every doctor is going to be right for every patient. We've noted that. On the other hand, take a look at source number 28 from Yeshua Neuwirth, as quoted by Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham and Nishmas Avram. He said, Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth pointed out to me, what will be when a man trusts only a certain doctor, even though there are other doctors who would treat for free? He only wants the doctor who requires payment. Will we force that doctor to treat for free? Right? He says, if you're going to really tell me that I, as a doctor, have to worry that the patient can only be healed by me, the logical conclusion you're going to come to is, therefore, every patient who wants my care is going to be entitled to it, and I won't be able to demand payment. That's a ridiculous situation. That's one question. The other question is, we're talking in extremes here by making every case a life and death case. What if it's not a life and death case? What if it's a quality of life case? He has some kind of an injury that he can live with chronically. He has some kind of a condition he can live with chronically. I, as a doctor, could potentially improve his situation, but am I really bound if it's not about saving his life? Rabbi Yehuda Leib Tzirilson in 20th century Russia wrote about this in source number 29, and he said, yes. He said the obligation is not only in life and death situations. When the Torah says that you shall restore one's property to him, and there we understand that to mean restoring one's health, that isn't just about life and death situations. The obligation is beyond life-saving. So what we're getting out of this is that, number one, if you're really going to coerce doctors to treat where they're not going to be paid, you're going to make it very difficult for people to become doctors, because they could really be forced to treat patients nonstop. On the other hand, we do have this precedent, which seems to apply even outside of life and death cases. So I think where we do draw the line is where you're going to affect the quality of the practice overall. And this patient is not in a life and death situation, where by treating this patient, spending your time on this patient, you are now harming other patients because you're diminishing the quality of the practice, because you're taking a lot of time for the patient, and where the patient can survive without your care reasonably. That's where the option kicks in of saying, I need to discontinue, I need to refer this patient elsewhere. And the precedent for it is source number 30. Rabbi J. David Bleich, writing about physician strikes in Israel, quoting Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss. He says, an interesting point regarding the level of services which must be provided during a strike is reflected in a letter addressed to the medical staff of Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, signed by two leading rabbinic authorities, published in the journal Asia. The signatories, Rabbi Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss and Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, report that it had come to their attention that the number of physicians available to treat patients fell below the number of physicians customarily on duty on Shabbos, which presumably is the level necessary to make sure you're preserving life. Assuming that the Shabbos staff is the minimum necessary for purposes of pikuach nefesh, of saving lives, those authorities declared that the members of the medical staff are obligated to assure the presence of medical personnel, quote, not fewer in number than on the holy Sabbath days. So as long as you make sure that it is sufficient to, that this person's life is not in danger, number one. And number two, where the alternative is a real deterioration in the quality of your practice and the care for patients in general, then there may be grounds to go to that third step in the CPSO's guidance of saying, I need to find a way to send this patient somewhere else. Obviously, it's better if you're able to accommodate, if this is doable. But you have to know your practice and your financial situation, and make that assessment. That's not something that somebody else can assess for you. Comments or questions on that? Or was that straightforward? Okay, then let's go to number five. Someone wrote in the chat, so what is my obligation to providing medication? What do you mean? I'm not sure I understand the question. As a pharmacist. Oh, you mean providing medication to somebody who comes into the pharmacy and says, I can't pay, but I need this medication. Got it. So here I actually feel like I'm on pretty good ground, in saying that, there is an option for the pharmacist. Well, let me step back one step. Is the pharmacist on the hook for the medicine they're dispensing? In other words, they're shelling out for this medicine. Is that the way it works? Okay. So if that's the case, that the pharmacist is paying for the medicine, then we actually have precedent in a halacha brought by Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau in his Pisrei Choshen. Rabbi Blau discusses the case of a person who runs a grocery, and needy people come into the grocery, and they say, we would like to get food off of your shelves on tab. We're poor. We need it. It's tzedakah. We'll pay you when we eventually are able to pay you. So Rabbi Blau's response is that the grocer is not required to provide that food. Again, assuming it's not a life and death case. And the reason why is because the grocer needs to have the money from the sale of this food in order to buy more inventory. if the grocer is just going to keep on extending credit to needy people, they're going to go out of business. And you're not required to go out of business in order to provide for others. So assuming that you're not talking a life and death case, the pharmacist would be able to say, you know, this is past the threshold of tzedakah that I can afford to give. I think that would be a reasonable answer. As always, I'm going to tell you to, you know, talk to the rabbi if you have a practical question. But you know, I'm running down to the end of when I'm able to say that. I'm gonna have trouble soon. But I think that that's a reasonable response. Okay. Case number five is the late night visitor. So this is one that I know happens to medical professionals all the time. It happens late at night. It happens on Shabbos. It happens when you're on vacation. Yeah, fill in the blank with the case that you want to give. Case number five in the vignettes. At 11 p.m., and yes, I see the note from Dr. Kirshen, they could direct the person to social programs that can offer financial support. Absolutely true. Case number five. At 11 p.m. on a Thursday night, as she tries to cook for Shabbos, Susan receives a text from her friend Cynthia, whose five-year-old son is showing signs of strep throat. Cynthia wants to bring her son over for a quick throat culture. Is Sarah required to help Cynthia? Did I change the doctor's name from Susan to Sarah? Yeah, I did. Sorry about that. So is Susan required to help Cynthia? I will note, by the way, just as a reminder for people, if you didn't sign in the chat already, please make sure you sign in. Otherwise, I will not be able to give you a letter confirming that you were here. If you already signed in, you're fine.
If we've already learned that one is allowed to miss davening, for a man to miss davening in order to get care.
Yeah.
So one has to put that into the consideration of what our obligation is to give care at an inconvenient time.
So Zev says that you have a duty to give care, and we do view it as being so important that when we had our shiur some years back on minyan versus medicine, it was there indeed was the possibility of skipping minyan in order to be able to provide medical care. That's one argument. On the other hand, there's a note in the chat. No, Cynthia can go elsewhere. Why does it have to be you at 11 o'clock at night when you're trying to cook for Shabbos? There are, you know, urgent cares or ERs and people are able to go there. They don't want to go there, but they could go there. I see a bunch of notes in the chat, actually. One is about the previous case. If someone can discharge a patient for lack of payment, or if they're making lashon hara, why can't a physician discharge the donkey that is putting other people at mortal risk? I definitely hear that point. Going back to the case before, I think there is something different in the sense that the cases that we saw before are less clear in terms of the risk than what we're talking about here. But I definitely hear your point. The note here: there is no obligation to see Cynthia's son. Not life threatening, and care is available elsewhere tomorrow. It's a mitzvah to help. Definitely see that argument as well. Others, comments before I go to some sources?
I was going to say,
yeah,
when I was a child, this question wouldn't even have come up because the doctors did work all hours of the day and night. And if my mother called the doctor at night because I was sick, he would come. There would be no question.
Okay.
The times have changed.
I hear that. Note
it's also a duty of the physician to look after themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And at 11 o'clock at night, in order to be able to do the work tomorrow, and because this doesn't sound like an emergency,
yeah,
an additional question.
Right. It definitely doesn't sound like an emergency. And the duty of the patient, of the doctor, to look after themselves is a real issue. Rabbi Elazar Papo, I think it's him, in his Pele Yoetz. I actually have it on the shelf here somewhere. the under chesed, the heading of chesed, of kindness to others, makes the point that one's first obligation in chesed is to oneself. You know, the term today, self-care, has a lot of different meanings, but it's not new, it's not original. There is a requirement of looking after oneself. Also added note from Dr. Sturm in the chat, you are satisfying the patient, not caring for the child's needs. Satisfying the parent, not caring for the child's needs. There's something to be said for that. This case actually could take us right back to case number 3, come to think of it. Right? If you say no to Cynthia, you may hear about it in Shul on Shabbos. So this will take us right back to number 3. So when someone comes to you in shul and says to you, you know, I heard what Cynthia said, that she wanted your help and you refused. You know, we could try Dr. Saffer's routine of saying, well, are you sure you know the whole story? Maybe. So looking at what we have here on the sheet, and I mentioned this source as well when we did the Jewish community practice session several years ago. Dr. Fred Rosner, in an article, Physician Strikes in Jewish Law, 1993, asks, if we're really against physician strikes, does that mean that physicians are obligated always to be available for their patients? And he says, this question requires additional deliberation and consultation with competent rabbinic authorities. He isn't sure about the possibility of saying certain hours are off limits. But there are definitely 3 grounds to be brought for saying, no, you do not have an obligation to see this patient at 11 o'clock at night. Number 1, the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, points out, the mitzvah of lo samod al dam reyecha, don't stand by while somebody else's blood is shed, does not carry a penalty for failing to fulfill it. That tells you something. In other words, the violation is one of inaction, not of action, and therefore it doesn't carry a penalty, and therefore it could well be outweighed by the needs of the moment. That's number 1. Number 2, by working too hard, you may make yourself a less effective physician, right? With the patients you're going to be seeing on Friday. This is something that we say in other areas of life. The Pesachei Choshen, Rabbi Blau, who I quoted earlier, talks about the fact that if you are an employee in a business, you're not allowed to stay up late at night, even working. Let's say you're moonlighting, you're taking another job. You're not allowed to do that because that will reduce your efficacy the next day. You will become a worse worker the following day. So maybe by taking the patient at 11 o'clock at night, I will become less attentive. My decisions will become poorer decisions on the following day. So there's that concern as well. And number 3, as noted, they have other options. And I refer you to source number 32 on the sheet from Rabbi Yosef Shalom Al-Yashiv, quoted in the Nishmas Avram. When a doctor is in a place where there is no shortage of doctors, and it is clear that the patient could find a doctor to treat him, and the case for which he has been called is not urgent, the doctor may decline to see the patient when he is busy eating or resting. So you have the ability to say, you have other options, take one of the other options. The area, though, where I would exercise caution, and then I want to get back to a note from Dr. Felder in the chat, because I think that it's also important in this regard. But one thing I would note is, what happens when you say, for this person, for Cynthia, yeah, I'm not going to take her. However, there's somebody else who's a close friend of mine who, identical situation, they call me up on Thursday night, I would take them. I think that's a little dicier. You can come up with justifications, but I think that that's an ethical question. That's, you know, if you really need your sleep, then you really need your sleep. If you need to cook for Shabbos, you really need to cook for Shabbos. To start to say, well, for this person I can, for this person I can't, I think is a challenge. To answer the question in the chat, don't we all do favors for our family and friends? I hope so. But when you're saying to somebody, I can't see you because I'm exhausted, I need to cook for Shabbos, it's going to be bad for my practice of medicine tomorrow, it's problematic to then, you know, 5 minutes later, your friend calls to say, oh, sure, come on over. I think that's difficult. I don't just mean difficult. I'm conceptually difficult. I think it's ethically difficult. So, I don't know. It's not easy. I mean, it's reminiscent of the Gemara that talks about, the Gemara in Bava Metzia, talks about how when we talk about returning someone's lost property, and we talk about helping them if their animal is struggling under a burden. So at one point, the Torah actually says, when it's your enemy, specifically, you encounter your enemy's ox. And it's the Gemara asks, in the event that you have a choice between your enemy's ox and your friend's ox, which one do you help? And the answer that's given is you help the enemy's ox first, because it's an opportunity to overpower your Yetzer Hara. No word on how the ox feels about this, but this is an opportunity for you to work on your character. So I think there's something to be said for not saying, well, I'm going to take this person because this person is my friend. I think that requires some thought. The other thing that requires some thought is the point that Dr. Felder made in the chat, which is often patients say that they didn't want to bother their physician. You may need to be careful to accept the 11 o'clock phone call from people who otherwise are not going to reach out when they're in need. If they have the sense of, this is inappropriate for me to reach out at this time, yeah, the unintended, undesired result may be that that they don't call you when they really need you. So that's something to be cautious about. At the very least, you need to draw clear lines and make sure the patient knows when it is okay for them to reach out. And different practices will be different in this regard. There may be a difference for a psychologist or a therapist, as opposed to some other practices. The doctor writes in the chat, most patients don't have our addresses and cell numbers. That may be true, but the one who's your neighbor in Davin's next to you in Shul, mate, or they know how to get it. Yes, Andrea.
I think with your vignette.
Yeah.
You're talking about somebody who there is no doctor-patient relationship. It's a friend or an acquaintance. And quite honestly, it's human nature. If my child calls and says my grandchild is sick, I don't care what time they call me. But if somebody who I barely know calls me at 11 o'clock at night, whether I'm cooking for Shabbos or whether I'm trying to go to sleep before 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to be less responsive to them. And I have no, if they're not my patients, I have no medical legal obligation to them. Halachically, I'm not sure, from what you said, whether I have an obligation just because they've called me. But again, it's human nature. If somebody you're close to calls you for medical advice, you're more likely to be responsive than if somebody who you barely know.
Right.
You see it more as an imposition, where somebody you're friendly with or very close to calls, you see it as, oh, you want to help them, you know.
Right.
They're your close friend, they're your relative.
Right. Now, and you're reminding me of a source that may be relevant in this discussion. The Gemara talks about my obligation to help other people, specifically when I see them, kisir'eh, when you see. And the Gemara defines the distance, and it says something like, I think it's 30 ris, which is a particular distance away, then you have a duty to help them, otherwise you don't. So we had a program from the Beit Midrash, I want to say 2011, where as part of the discussion, we were talking about helping other people. That was the theme in it. Rabbi Baruch Weintraub, who was our skan at the time, talked about the idea that your duty to help others begins when you feel sympathy for them. Like when you see somebody else physically, when you see somebody else emotionally. And that there's a greater obligation of mercy when you actually have a bond of some kind, and that pulls at you. And I wonder, I'm just thinking aloud. I don't know. I wonder if that might be relevant here as well. I also see the note in the chat from Aubie. Patients who are also friends and tend to abuse the relationship ultimately strain the friendship. That's for sure. And that's the fear that the patient has as well. You know, before we started the session this evening, there was a comment of, what about the patient side of things and dealing with the difficult physician and the difficult medical professional? I feel like that could be a session in its own right that I probably will not give to physicians. But that may come into play in this discussion in terms of the patient who feels like they're not allowed to intrude and they're not allowed to ask the question. Because that's a phenomenon. You know, the one who feels like, you know, the physician needs to move on and I can't ask another question while in the appointment. That's a hazard. Goes a little bit back towards Dr. Felder's comment as well. Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone. We do have one session left, the one on compelling medical care.